You can listen to all episodes of Leonard ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's just insane. I don't, it's still tough for me to like properly encapsulate the story that is Leonard Peltier, because it's just so rich with things that are so unjust and like so infuriating, and yet it still stands.
That's reporter Jen Bendry with the Huffington Post. For the last year, she's been covering the Biden clemency push and doing an incredible job at it, helping almost single-handedly to bring Leonard's story back into the mainstream media.
It's like this big burning dumpster fire in plain sight, and people just kind of walking by it casually. And it doesn't seem to be getting a ton of attention. I don't understand why this is like still okay. So I just keep writing about Leonard Peltier being in prison and how insane it is. And hopefully something starts to gain some traction, because in the end, I think Leonard is simply going to die in prison, or he's going to go home. And it's not going to be that much longer for one of those to have to happen.
You're listening to Leonard, a podcast series about Leonard Peltier, one of America's longest-serving political prisoners. I'm Rory Owen Delaney.
And I'm Andrew Fuller. We've spent the last 4 years working to share Leonard's story with a new generation of people. Who he is, how he ended up behind bars, and why we believe he deserves to go free. This is Season 2, Episode 7, Big Burning Dumpster Fire. In this chapter, we chat with journalist Jen Bendry about her work on the political front lines in Washington, D.C. Recently, Ms. Bendry had the chance to interview Leonard over the phone, a rare occurrence in recent years. We asked Jen about the process.
I put in a request to interview Leonard in the fall. And when you want to interview someone in a maximum security federal prison, you have to make an official request through this form. You have to figure out a prisoner's like ID number. You have to do all these like bureaucratic steps. So I did all that. And then I was like emailing with the Bureau of Prisons to follow up and say, okay, I did it. You know, now what? It took months. I don't know why. I think they just ignored it for a little while. For months being a little while. So that was probably like October, November when I put in the request. And then I got an email in like January saying that like your request has been approved. And I said, great, this is great. But then nothing. And so I was emailing with these people saying, hi, you said it was approved. Can we please set up a time and day and like ASAP? And I got nothing. And then I think in March, I saw that an NBC reporter wrote a piece and they had just talked to Leonard on the phone. And I was like, what? What is that about? Like NBC, like, why did they just give them a phone interview with Leonard when they're not even like reporting on him at all? Like, what the hell? But then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to chalk that up as a win, because look, like NBC News is now paying attention suddenly out of nowhere. And they're NBC News. So maybe the Bureau of Prisons was like, oh, a major television, you know, news network wants to talk to one of our inmates. So then I wrote back to the Bureau of Prisons and I said, hi, remember how I emailed you in like October about doing this? And then you said, I got it and nothing happened. Well, I see that you just granted an interview to NBC News. So where's mine? And suddenly they were like, okay, yeah, we can do it. How about we do it next week or something? So then that suddenly like came to fruition very quickly. I don't know why that played out like that, but it took me like 4 or 5 months to make a phone call happen. It was just a phone call. And I guess in their defense, during the pandemic, there have been prison lockdowns for COVID precautions. And during the lockdowns, you're not allowed to talk on the phone. So I know that Leonard's prison, for one, had a number of back-to-back lockdowns, which means they were like pretty much isolated in their cells for sometimes days, weeks at a time, which is its own separate issue. You know, there's some serious like isolation and mental health issues that can develop from being all alone like that in the middle of a pandemic in a cell. But I do think that was the reason for some of the delays. But I think that they also just didn't want to do it. I have to believe that, because it shouldn't take 5 months to get a 30-minute phone call. But in the end, I got it.
The Huffington Post published Jen's interview with Leonard from behind bars in Coleman Federal Prison on May 7th, 2022. Follow her on Twitter at jbendry to read all of her stories as soon as they go live.
He sounds just like someone's grandpa. You know, he was like talking about how he likes to bullshit in the yard with his buddies and they just hang out. He told a lot of stories from his younger years, you know, those kinds of things. So I just like listened to him talk. But I did have some very specific things I wanted to ask him. And one of the things I asked him was, what would he say to President Biden if he had 5 minutes alone with him? He said he would thank him for actually making some headway on some of the issues around justice for Native Americans that Leonard himself was fighting for in the 70s when he was part of AIM, which was the American Indian Movement that was like the civil rights group fighting for Indigenous people's rights. So I thought that was interesting. His first response was that he would thank Biden as he's sitting in prison. But then he said he would also tell him that I'm innocent. And this is almost a direct quote. He said, I didn't kill anyone. I'm innocent. And I would really like to go home to see my family. That was what he would like to tell Biden. And so then I asked him what he would say if he had 5 minutes alone with the FBI director. He didn't even hesitate when I could barely finish that question. He was like, oh, I would tell the FBI director to stop killing my people. I was like, okay. And I honestly wasn't quite sure what he meant by that. Like, I know what that means in the 70s era of the FBI, but I'm not sure what that means today. But he clearly has some strong feelings about what the FBI has done to Native people, which I think those are some justified feelings.
Back in the 70s on Pine Ridge, the feds backed tribal president Dick Wilson and his goons versus the Oglala Traditionals in a bloody civil war that is said to have claimed the lives of over six dozen AIM supporters during a period of time known as the Reign of Terror.
Mostly I wanted to let him talk because I just wanted him to have a chance to talk about what was on his mind and how life has been for him lately in prison and just the things he's been thinking about lately, how his health is, things like that. I asked him if he thought he was going to die in prison. He said he just didn't know. And he kind of got quiet. And he said, you know, I shouldn't be here in the first place. And so that was that. And then, you know, you're pretty restricted to exactly 30 minutes in a 30-minute phone call in prison. So like suddenly our call was done and he had to go. But, you know, he's a talker. He talked a lot and he likes to tell stories. And, you know, he's a painter. So he talked about, he's actually a very good painter. He talked about how there's an art room in the prison that has been closed throughout the pandemic, but he talked about how he heard it was going to open again for the first time in like 2 or 3 years and how that was like very exciting. And it was a mostly one-way conversation for him to just talk a little bit and then me to throw in a couple of questions at the end. But it was good. He's a good conversationalist. Like he's a good interview.
He called me one time a couple of years ago. So I got about 10 or 15 minutes, but like you said, he just sounds like, you know, somebody's grandpa or your uncle or he just sounds like a pretty regular guy.
He does. It was kind of striking because I mean, and he does, you know, he's got children of his own. He's got grandkids. Granted, he's been in prison like the whole fucking time that like he's had them, but he's got a fairly sizable family, I think. And you can tell that he's like in his way, like tried to help raise them. Like he mentioned a couple times, like the things he said to his kids and his grandkids about like his advice in certain situations. And he mentioned that his daughter reached out to him for his blessing, basically, to go to New York City right after 9/11. I think she's a paramedic and she wanted to go to New York to help when it was like, you know, at the height of chaos and devastation. And she asked him, I think, for permission to go. And he was like, of course you can go, like, you know, do what you need to do to thrive. But he seemed to think that was like a really key moment, like as a dad, that she asked his opinion on that. And he did. He did sound just kind of like a regular guy, you know, with his family and his hobbies of painting and making art. It's just that he's sitting in a prison cell. And if you know the backstory to it, it's just insane. You know,
and the fact that he's still alive. And
I know. Yeah,
I mean, he's how many still alive people and don't know about it?
Honestly, like the fact that a lot of people don't know who he is still is a problem. I mean, and it's understandable. But I think if anything's going to get him out of prison, it's public sentiment that is just piling on to the president. And he does seem to have a very, very strong group of supporters. And again, like I said, there's celebrities who have a big platform on social media who have, you know, used it to call for him to go home, and like human rights leaders, indigenous leaders. And with social media, people just have more of a platform to amplify these kinds of things, which they didn't have in 1977. So it's a different time for someone like him. He's sort of a holdover to me from a different era of criminal justice and righting of wrongs. And I don't know, I can see how a younger generation could latch onto this and get pissed and sign on to like this effort to get him out, which is sort of crazy to me because it's from so long ago, but people who were not even born yet and who still weren't born yet decades later, today, I could see it. I could see how everything that he has come to represent matches so much of where a young progressive movement of people is today. It just weirdly lines up in my mind.
Yeah, we're with you on that one. That was one of our whole things was that if there's ever going to be a time where it would make sense for there to be a social movement, it would seem to be now. But I saw that Leonard had spoken about Bill Janklow and that Chansita Eagle Deer thing. It's a story that I know Andrew and I are fascinated by.
We were interested to hear Jen's take on Jacinta Eagle Deer, a young Native American woman who in the late 60s alleged she was sexually assaulted by a white man, a lawyer who would later become one of the most powerful players in South Dakota political history, William Bill Janklow.
I was asking Leonard if he saw a full circle moment with where we are today compared to what he was doing with AIM in the 70s, which, again, it feels sort of incredible to me that I see it. And one thing I brought up was, you know, much more attention, much more national attention on missing and murdered Indigenous women. And that has been a decades, if not centuries old crisis, like a legitimate crisis of Native women just disappearing and being murdered. And it's a thing. It's a real thing that's been happening all over the place. And it just doesn't get very much attention because it's Native American women. And traditionally, national media doesn't pay attention to them. Local media doesn't pay a ton of attention to them. Our law enforcement system doesn't pay attention to them. It's a whole multi-layered problem here.
Murder is the third leading cause of death for Indigenous women, per the CDC, with Native women being killed at a rate 10 times higher than all other ethnicities in the United States. The Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women Movement, MMIW, advocates for the end of violence against Native women.
But I mentioned this with Leonard because I'm like, it's actually like starting to get some real attention now with Deb Haaland at Interior creating a whole commission to like examine this and dig up old cases. And the Justice Department is actually working with Interior Department to do this too. And President Biden talks about it, which the fact that a president is talking about this at all is a big deal. And I mentioned this to Leonard as like a possible example of something that he's like trying to raise attention about in the 70s. And he said, oh yeah, like it was happening all the time. Like Native women all the time were just being like raped and treated like shit by white men in positions of power. And that's when he brought up this case of, is it Janklow? I had never heard of this case before Leonard mentioned it, but this guy who is like a very powerful white man who basically like was known in the community for raping young Indigenous women. And this one woman in particular, who he apparently raped and like cast aside somewhere, and AIM members got involved. I think they approached local law enforcement, said like, this woman has been raped, and I can't remember the chronology. I don't want to mess this up, but she turned up dead.
On January 14th, 1967, a 15-year-old student at an Indian boarding school on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota alleges she's been raped by the director of the tribe's legal services program, William Janklow.
The school principal escorts Jacinta Eagle Deer to the hospital, where records suggest that an attack has occurred. The incident is then assigned to a BIA investigator, who files a report recommending that Mr. Janklow be prosecuted. The BIA's recommendation triggers an investigation by the FBI, who holds federal jurisdiction over major crimes committed on reservations. But the Bureau closes the case just 6 weeks later after concluding the allegations were unfounded.
In response, Chansita's stepmom swears she'll prove Janklow raped her daughter, but she never does. On December 6th, 1972, Delphine Eagle Deer was found dead in a barren winter field after a beating by the BIA police. 2 years later, in 1974, William Janklow receives the Republican nomination to become South Dakota's next Attorney General.
To discredit him, the American Indian Movement seeks to resuscitate the Jacinta Eagle Deer rape investigation, but the organization runs into a brick wall when they are unable to locate Jacinta, the BIA investigator, or any supporting documents. That is, until Douglas Durham gets involved.
Yes, that Douglas Durham, the notorious FBI informant who infiltrated AIM after being discharged from the Des Moines police over suspicions that he killed his first wife.
Remember, it's 1974 still, and Durham won't be exposed as a Fed until the following year in 1975, so at this juncture, he's still playing double agent.
While Durham can't find any of the official records, he locates Jacinta Eagle Deer and pushes for AIM to use her story to derail Janklow's campaign for state attorney general. But leadership wants hard evidence before going public, so Dennis Banks petitions to have Janklow disbarred in Rosebud Reservation Tribal Court in an effort to obtain the BIA reports needed to substantiate Eagle Deer's allegations.
However, Janklo knows tribal law inside out from his years working on the res and refuses to answer his summons, i.e. no-shows. In his absence, tribal court judge Mario Gonzalez charges Janklo with assault with intent to commit rape and carnal knowledge of a female under 16. But all the court can really do is revoke his tribal law license since he's not subject to tribal jurisdiction as a white man.
Meanwhile, Douglas Durham makes Eagle Deer his girlfriend and gets her to repeat her accusations on Sioux Falls television. But Janklo dismisses the rape charge as a crude smear campaign and leans on his record as a public servant to quell any outrage. In concert with the anti-AIMS sentiment sweeping the state in the aftermath of Wounded Knee, the spin job propels Janklo to a landslide victory that makes him the top lawyer and law enforcement official in South Dakota, the Attorney General. In January 1975, Janklo assumes office, and in March, Douglas Durham confesses to being an FBI informant at an AIM press conference in Chicago. Afterward, he and Jancita Eagle Deer disappear from the scene.
One of the last people to see Jancita alive is her brother. On April 4, 1975, at about 1 p.m., Alfred Eagle Deer recalls a dark-haired man in a blue Chevy picking up his sister from his house near Valentine, Nebraska, just south of the Rosebud Reservation. 230 miles away, on a deserted stretch of road outside Aurora, Nebraska, Jancita would be struck down and killed by a fast-moving car, seemingly trying to flag down the vehicle that took her life.
According to the pursuant AIM investigation, the coroner indicated Jancita might have been previously beaten or injured by jumping from a moving car, but explained it would be impossible to determine for sure due to the extreme nature of her injuries. The celebrated poet, musician, actor, and AIM activist, John Trudell, was convinced Durham played a role in Jancita's death, telling author Peter Matheson, quote, "I know he did it. He brought her in and used her to seal a permanent enmity between Janklo and AIM, but she had evidence against him, and he got rid of her."
So Durham skated in the end, and so did the state AG William Janklo, who cultivated a public image as an Indian fighter to win even higher political offices in the years to come.
Then he went on to like run for governor, and he won, and he basically, his career just like ascended, you know? He just carried on with his life and prospered. But back at the community level, Native people who knew him and knew what he had been doing were just like, this is awful. This is like everything wrong here with this guy. And when I was talking to Leonard about it and learning about this case from him, he was like, you know, Jen, this happened all the time. It wasn't like this one Janklo guy was like this case we were just all mad about. It was all the time. It was young Indigenous women just being treated like objects, just being cast aside as trash, being picked up on the side of the road, beaten, raped, and killed. And life just moved on without law enforcement doing anything. And so I could feel it even when Leonard was talking on the phone, like how, I mean, there's just so many stories behind that one story that he knew. And it was so commonplace that it just wasn't outrageous to people in positions of power at the time. It's just accepted. And, you know, this is also a time when, you know, Indigenous people weren't allowed into certain restaurants or bars, and there would be a sign out front that said, you know, no Indians, no dogs. This is not that long ago. So that was the era in which Leonard was operating, and the era in which he was part of AIM, which was trying to form a united group of Native people to fight back against Native women being raped and discarded all the time by white men, and to fight back against their land being taken away and treaty obligations not being upheld, and to fight back against children being stolen from their families and put into boarding schools, and to fight back. I mean, it's just like one thing after another. And so all this to say, yes, that the story of Janklo that Leonard brought up was an example of the kinds of things that Leonard was very animated by in the 70s. And even today in 2022, he was clearly like still angry, you know, and rightfully so. It was pretty terrible stuff. And here he sits in prison.
After the break, Jen details the growing political support for Leonard in Washington, D.C., and identifies the biggest obstacle in his path to freedom, the FBI.
This is Sunny Singh of Hate56.com, and you're listening to Leonard, a podcast series about America's longest-serving political prisoner, Leonard Peltier. The mission of Hate56 has been and will always be to provide people with equal access to free, high-quality live music videos of punk and hardcore bands. Outside of my music coverage, I do a lot of volunteer video work for many Black, Brown, and Indigenous movements and causes, including the annual National Day of Mourning in Plymouth, Massachusetts. I've been documenting that since 2011, and each year I record the statement sent from Leonard Peltier, which is read by one of the elders in attendance. The mission operandi of Hate56 has been to virtually gather people around entertainment, in this case live music videos, while also weaponizing the platform to signal boost important issues. To check out my work, visit hate56.com, that's the number 5 in word 6, or follow me on YouTube, youtube.com/hate56, or check me out on Instagram, @hate56. But above all, please join me in the fight to free Leonard Peltier. Call the White House, sign the clemency petition, and share this podcast with your family and friends. Just in the last few years alone, the tireless work of community activists and organizers have brought home many of our aging political prisoners, including the members of the Move 9, Debbie Africa, Mike Africa Sr., Eddie Africa, Janet Africa, Janine Africa, Delbert and Chuck Africa. May they both rest in power. We've also brought home many veteran Black Panthers, including Jaleel Muntakim, Sundiata Kohli, and Russell Maroon Schultz. May he rest in power. The time is now to stand up for what is right and bring an innocent man home. Hashtag Free Leonard Peltier.
To me, as a political reporter, it's a really fascinating time to talk about him because it's like an open wound that many Indigenous people still feel with him being in prison. And I'm watching very closely to see if that's something that this administration sees as sort of a low-hanging fruit, like something they can do. Biden can unilaterally do this if he feels it's important and it matters to a constituency of Americans. So this could be a very unique window for Leonard to go home. The Biden administration really prides itself on the kinds of progressive reforms that they've been talking about. They've made real gains for Native American communities. They've done a lot already to lift up tribal governments, to strengthen tribal sovereignty. You know, they've lifted up the issue of addressing decades of missing and murdered Indigenous women. They have put a spotlight on the history in this country of Indian boarding schools, and they've deployed people to go to former boarding schools to unearth the remains of children who were killed and died at these boarding schools, who had already been stolen from their families by the U.S. government and forced into these white, you know, conversion schools. That they're actually making an effort to put attention on that because they want to try to right these wrongs, and they're really proud that they do that. There's other things I can list off that this administration has already done to show that they want to make a difference on issues that are really important to Native American people. And the fact that Leonard Peltier is still hanging out there, still in prison, with all these decades of ugly issues wrapped up in it, and with that all coming to a head today with this old man in prison who shouldn't be there, it just seems like this could be a really unique moment, a unique and perhaps last final moment for Leonard to get clemency. The times have sort of caught up with what he represents, and the views of this administration are actually fairly aligned with the push for releasing someone like Leonard.
Can you speak a little bit about some of the allies Leonard has in Congress?
Yes. Senator Leahy and Senator Schatz have both publicly put out letters and statements saying that they think it's time for Leonard to go home. And their argument is Leonard Peltier has been in prison for almost 50 years. He is not a threat to society, and he's an old man who's a painter and just wants to go home before he dies. And he's got some health issues, and this is a compassionate release issue. So that is the argument being made by Senator Schatz, who is the chairman of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, and Patrick Leahy, who is the senator pro tem. He's the longest serving person in the Senate right now, so he's seen a lot of American history and a lot in the criminal justice system in his time in the Senate. So those are two very powerful voices to have in there publicly urging the president to grant clemency. There's at least 10 or 12 House Democrats who have publicly also written letters and said, Mr. President, please grant clemency to Leonard Peltier. It's time for him to go home. And I know from my own reporting that there are other senators who, it appears, are ready to start talking about it publicly. The question is, what difference is it going to make? Is it going to really affect Biden to hear one more senator saying something? Maybe. I don't know. You know, as someone who's trying to put a spotlight on this, I try to get anybody to talk about it in there. I don't know what's in Biden's head about it right now. I don't know if it's in his head at all. I don't know if you guys saw this, but during a Senate hearing a few weeks ago, Senator Schatz asked Attorney General Merrick Garland about this, which was sort of a curveball question at the end of a hearing about a budget issue. And basically, Senator Schatz said, you know, what do you make of Leonard Peltier's imprisonment? Because the Attorney General has some authority here to, you know, move forward with a clemency request.
Final question, easy one. What is your position on clemency for Leonard Peltier?
So this is a matter that goes into applications, go to the pardon attorney. Pardon attorney makes recommendations through the Deputy Attorney General to the president. And so I'm not going to comment on that now.
That's Attorney General Merrick Garland being pressed by Brian Schatz, a Democratic senator from the great state of Hawaii, who is carrying the mantle of former Hawaii senator and outspoken Peltier supporter Robert Inouye. May he rest in peace.
Can you comment on where we are in the process?
I assume, but don't know that an application has been made. I actually don't even know whether, I mean, I've read about this in the press, so I don't know anything more about it than what I've read in the press.
And this doesn't cross your desk?
Certainly not as an initial or even secondary matter. This goes to the pardon attorney and then the deputy attorney general. I'm not saying I wouldn't be involved, but it certainly has not crossed my desk.
Garland basically said he didn't know much about the case and that he really only knew what he's read about it in the news. So that was pretty surprising to me because that tells me, A, the attorney general doesn't seem to be aware of this clemency petition. Okay. And B, the only information the attorney general does know about this is from what he reads in the news, which I'm like, well, I'm the only person writing about Leonard Peltier in DC right now. So does that mean that the attorney general is sitting around reading the Huffington Post? Like, I don't know, because I don't know where else he'd be reading anything. So I was like, okay, that was an interesting response. So really, I don't know what's going on in the heads of the people who truly have the authority to grant clemency to Leonard. I don't know. I just know that there are people in Congress who are starting to pay more attention to this. I do think that you're going to start seeing more senators speaking up about it. And I think that you can't miss that if you're the president and if you're the attorney general, when members of your own party who are U.S. senators are publicly talking about the need to grant clemency to somebody again and again and again. Like, you just, at a certain point, that's got to get their attention. So we'll see.
Well, and real quick, I know you had spoken directly with Leahy, and he said he was planning to actually confront Biden face to face about Leonard. Do you know if that ever happened?
So I don't know that I would say confront. I mean, just to sure. Be clear, he said that he was going to bring it up with Biden in one of their upcoming meetings, and of which he had two meetings that were coming soon with the president about unrelated issues. So I don't think he was going to confront him. I think he was going to just ask him about it. And I have not seen him in person since we had that conversation. So that is definitely on my radar to ask him about it when I see him again. But I do believe that he brought it up with him because Leahy is a very influential senator and he and Biden have known each other for decades. I mean, they've worked together for so long. I mean, they talk very frankly, I would imagine. I think the consensus as to why Leonard Peltier is still in prison is pretty simple. I think it's because the FBI wants him to be in prison. And I don't think that they ever want him to get out of prison. That's about it. I mean, there's a lot beneath that, clearly. But I think that is the main obstacle to him still being in prison, like 46, 47 years later.
I know recently you had the FBI contact you after they had previously declined to comment on Leonard's case.
Yeah, that was a surprise. I emailed the Office of the Pardon Attorney, which for anyone who listens to your podcast, if they don't know what that is, it's simply the federal office that decides who should get pardons, who should get clemency. They make the recommendation in this office. They review cases. They make recommendations to the Deputy Attorney General. And then that Deputy Attorney General forwards it along to the president. So that's the pretty simple process for anyone who's appealing for clemency. That's what you do. So I just emailed the Office of the Pardon Attorney and said, hi, I'm someone who's a reporter. I've been following Leonard Peltier's imprisonment. And I'm just curious if you can give me a status update on his clemency petition. That's it. It was a pretty boring question, really, for the pardon attorney office, because I didn't ask anything about the case. I just wanted to know the status of his clemency petition, which was filed last summer. And in response, the FBI emailed and said, hi, Jen, here's our statement on why we oppose Leonard Peltier is released from prison. And there was a provided two paragraph statement. So that was weird. And then they wrote back again right after they sent that email. And they said, oh, and if you have any more questions, you should contact the Office of the Pardon Attorney. So after I took a minute or two and just sat there with like, what is happening? I read their statement to see what their argument was. And it was just full of nonsense. It was clearly an outdated, ill thought through statement on why they want him to remain in prison.
Here's the FBI's unsolicited statement to Jen Bendry, verbatim.
The FBI remains resolute against the commutation of Leonard Peltier's sentence for murdering FBI Special Agents Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams at South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. We must never forget or put aside that Peltier intentionally and mercilessly murdered these two young men and has never expressed remorse for his ruthless actions. Peltier's conviction, rightly and fairly obtained, still stands and has withstood numerous appeals to multiple courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. No amount of prison time changes the facts surrounding Kohler and Williams' deaths, and commuting Peltier's sentence now would only serve to diminish the brutality of his crime and the suffering of their surviving families and the FBI family.
The argument that the FBI officially gave me, literally every sentence of it was full of holes. And I wrote an article after I got that email from the FBI. I was like, well, I might as well just like let people know this happened and also talk about why their statement is so bad. I mean, it wasn't even like a compelling argument. It said something to the effect of, you know, we at the FBI firmly believe that a man who murdered two FBI agents in cold blood should remain in prison forever. Okay, something like that was the first sentence. And I was like, okay, that's a pretty like over the top, you know, graphic first sentence to get your attention and make the case for someone staying in prison for such a horrible crime. But there was never evidence that Leonard Peltier murdered these two FBI agents, never mind in cold blood at point blank zero, all the details that they put in their statement. So they're starting from a flawed premise in their argument to me and their statement as to why they're opposing him being in prison. They glossed over the fact that there was never evidence that he murdered anybody. You know, they made the case in their statement that, you know, multiple courts have upheld his imprisonment. Again, it's like classic spin. If you actually understand what happened in this case, it's like, okay, yeah, multiple courts did uphold this case. That's because A, the Supreme Court never heard the case. And one of their arguments was that even the Supreme Court upheld this case. And it's like, no, they actually never heard the case. They turned it down because they turned down like gazillions of petitions to take on cases every year. And this is just one of them. So that's not really a fair argument. And it is true that an appeals court upheld a parole board's decision to keep him in prison. But that was because of a changed standard for what it means for someone to stay in prison after evidence has come out after someone's been put in prison that exonerates them. And this FBI statement just glossed over the fact that since Leonard was put in prison, it was shown that the government lied. They straight up lied. They got people to lie. The FBI threatened people to lie on their behalf. Now there are evidence that has come out that shows that they had proof that it wasn't Leonard's weapon. So then it's like, okay, that's a pretty big deal. And if that happened today, that would certainly nullify the trial. But the standard back then was different. I don't know how much your listeners know about all the details of this case, and I don't want to bore anybody with all the different things that have come up in like 45 years, but all this to say, bringing it back to the present, the FBI statement that unexpectedly landed in my inbox seemed to have either ignored or been unaware, probably ignored, all the damning details that have come out in the last few decades that simply undermine everything about the statement the FBI sent.
One of the most insane things about Leonard's case is what happened during his appeal for a new trial back in 1984 at the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis. There, exculpatory ballistics evidence was uncovered, forcing the government to admit that it didn't know who had killed the two FBI agents. So the feds dropped their contention that Leonard had committed murder in the first degree and went with an aiding and abetting theory in replacement.
Then the question is like, well, who was he aiding and abetting? Because they still don't. They don't know who did this. So it's a pretty questionable claim, but they decided to argue that Leonard had aided and abetted whoever did it because he was present that day. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure how they settled on that as their legal reasoning, but it's a pretty weak argument to look at. And I think I would refer to James Reynolds, who is a former U.S. attorney who, as you guys know, was involved in helping to keep Leonard in prison, who has since turned around and said, actually, we were wrong. We never had any evidence and he needs to go home, like, which is pretty extraordinary in its own right.
James Reynolds, the former U.S. attorney in Iowa, arranged for his predecessor, who handled the original prosecution of Peltier, to fight Leonard's appeal in St. Louis.
A comparison that James Reynolds has made to me about that aiding and abetting conviction is like, you know, if that's the standard that we're using to put someone in prison for life, that they were present during a shootout, what does that mean for the people who are present on January 6th outside of the U.S. Capitol building? There was a mass gathering of people there. People were attacked. Some people died. There was 140 Capitol police officers injured. You know, it was a horrible day of violence, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people there. Does that mean that because they were all present, that they were all aiding and abetting the Capitol attack that day? And this is an example that James Reynolds suggested to me as to why it's so ludicrous that they could even get Leonard on the grounds of aiding and abetting in a murder. So it's like, you know, there's just many pieces to this. Again, as I don't want to keep saying again and again, but those are some pretty key parts to this that are why this case is particularly frustrating to see that, you know, it's stuck all these years, despite this, he is still in prison. So here we are in 2022, and I believe it's the same reason. Fundamentally, it is the FBI saying we're never letting him out. They will say because he murdered these two people in cold blood at point blank range, which is not true. There's no proof of that, at least. There is no evidence that he did this. Leonard himself has maintained his innocence. But the bigger issue is that presidents, one after another, even when it looked like they were on the verge of granting clemency to Leonard Peltier, that they did not. And for different reasons, I'm going to put it out there again, it goes back to the FBI. And now it's the Biden era. And the question is now, does Biden have it in him to let Leonard go home? And the answer is, I don't know.
News and notes. Now we can officially add Senator Mazie Hirono to the list of Leonard's supporters in the Senate. On May 31st, Jen Bendry reported that Senator Hirono sent a letter to President Biden urging him to free Leonard Peltier. It is clear that our criminal justice system failed Mr. Peltier, the Democrat from Hawaii said.
And on June 23rd, Senator Bernie Sanders became the fourth U.S. senator in recent months to advocate on behalf of one of America's longest-serving political prisoners. Leonard Peltier has spent over 40 years of his life in prison, despite the fact that the government has admitted they do not know who is responsible for the crime he was convicted of. For this reason, I have and will continue to strongly support petitions for Leonard Peltier's release, Sanders said.
This podcast is produced, written, and edited on Tongva land by Rory Owen Delaney and Andrew Fuller. Kevin McKiernan serves as our consulting producer.
Thanks to Wendy Weiner for dramatizing the FBI statement. Thanks to Bobby Halverson for the original music we're using throughout this series. And thanks to Mike Casantini at the Network Studios for his engineering assistance, and to Peter Lordson and Sycamore Sound for their audio mixing.
Special thanks to Jen Bendry for her reporting in the Huffington Post. And thanks most of all to Leonard Peltier.
To get involved and help Leonard, go to whoisleonardpeltier.info or find us on social media at Leonard_pod on Twitter and Instagram, or facebook.com/LeonardPodcast.
This podcast is a production of Man Bites Dog Films, LLC. Free Leonard Peltier.